and you're listening to The Science Show, available through your MP3, now as individual items, as well as the entire program. Both can be sent automatically to your computer, and we have transcripts going back about 8 years. Go to abc.net.au/rn and choose The Science Show, now in its 34th year. Now, imagine you're an ethologist, a scientist studying animal or even human behaviour, and you wanted to do research on human communication. What do you do? Watch people talk to each other over coffee? No, you'd be misled. A Martian scientist landing in Australia today, observing young humans communicating, would see them alone, walking, and holding their left or their right ears. They would conclude that communication is a solitary pursuit. That's the kind of conundrum Gillian Sebastian Forrester is up against. How to watch animals without imposing human assumptions about what they're actually doing. So she's taking notes of everything.
You're taking into consideration the timing and the spacing and a lot of contextual factors, like how close the animals are when they interact and the location where things happen. And is it one recipient or multiple recipients and so forth?
Yeah, because we do it as, ourselves when we're talking to each other. We look at each other, we gesticulate, we make noises. And there are lots of aspects beyond the plain words. And what you're saying is that the primates do this as well.
Absolutely. I think what I really wanted to do was take our study of animal behavior back to a very, very fundamental basic level where we're taking the actual individual actions and looking at them within context, and not subjectively prescribing analogous human repertoires of events to what's happening, which is very easy to do because they so closely mimic our behaviours. But to be honest, we don't really understand our own behaviours that well, so we really need to step backwards.
So you've actually got two cameras. You're doing, a one-shot of the actual creature and a two-shot showing the interaction with another animal and its context. So you're doing it as thoroughly as that and delineating how they cross over and interact.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then you make notes. Actually, what are the animals? Is it gorillas?
They are. They're Western lowland gorillas. And they're quite a special group because they live in a biological family, which means that there's one silverback who's fathered all the children and all the females and mothers. So it is as close to a natural wild family as you can get in captivity. And they're also semi-free ranging, which means that they're not just there for public viewing, but that the habitat was made to mimic the wild habitat. And you may or you may not see them on any given day based on what the family is doing.
Where is this?
This is at the Portland Wild Animal Park in Kent, the John Aspinall Foundation.
Oh, John Aspinall, wild character, I seem to remember. He was a gambling colleague of Kerry Packer's and one of these free enterprise merchants, wasn't he?
That's right. bit of a misanthrope as well.
Yes, interesting. Misanthrope in that there are many of us who love animals but are slightly leery about people.
And I think he was one of those characters.
Yeah.
But he set up an incredible foundation which now raises and nurtures endangered species in captivity with the goal, in a lot of cases, to re-enter them back into the wild. And they do this with the gorillas as well. They've got a reserve in the Congo called Lafini Reserve, in the Gabon, I believe, and take the orphaned apes and put them through a re-entry program back into the wild.
Yeah, we've discussed some of that on The Science Show, mainly with chimps and the Jane Goodall Institute. But now you've been looking at the gorillas' behaviour for some time, and so systematically. What has it told you about the sophistication or otherwise of their interactions?
Well, the interesting thing that I've found to date, and there's much more to be done, is that there is structure that hasn't been seen in previous or traditional studies of animal behavior. There is very, very systematic structure at a very low-lying level that we've completely neglected to see because we weren't investigating it from this broader approach.
So you're suggesting that their language and their communication, there's an awful lot going on there?
There is an awful lot going on. I wouldn't call it language because I wouldn't want to imply that they use the same sort of semantic and syntactic structure that we use. But I think what I'm finding is that they're using combinations of signals more consistently than we had seen before, and as this database of natural, visual, tactile, and auditory signals grows and grows, then you are able to glean those consistent patterns within the same context, and that is kind of giving you the foundation there of the structure.
Have you any idea really what's going on with their communication? What they're, I won't say saying, but what they're communicating? Is it sort of stuff for the village, you know, go over there, stop misbehaving, or share the food, or prosaic, things like that, or something slightly more profound?
I think that's what everybody wants to know, but that is kind of secondary to my actual research, which is to find a way to actually collect the data in such a way that we can analyze it without having to currently interpret it, but to extract the hallmark features, to extract the patterns. Personally, I imagine they're saying things that are very similar to what we say. They're social creatures. They navigate very complex social networks and hierarchies, and they've got similar desires and intentions as human beings.
You're a very rigorous scientist, but how do you respond to other people taking it differently, like Susan Savage Rambo in Georgia with Kanzi and the other bonobos, where they've become essentially part of the household and the communication is as if you've got a house guest and you just say, Kanzi, go and fetch the tongs so that we can do something with the barbecue, and off goes Kanzi and fetches them, implying it understood perfectly what was being said, but an unpredictable thing, really. So what do you make of that?
I think it's valid research. It's given us a lot of information about the capacity of chimps and other great apes. It's a completely different line of research from what I'm doing. I have to say, it is the research that got me interested initially in apes and communication, because I've always wanted to communicate with the animals. But it's looking more at the apes' capacity for human language. Now, rather than looking at the precursors to human speech, which may have developed from things, as we know, that are more based in the visual system, so visual gesturing.
Yeah, the same goes for the gorillas being taught more sophisticated, not sign language, but there were advances on the kinds of techniques used with chimps have been applied to gorillas more recently, that sort of thing as well.
The symbolic representations and the keyboards with the symbols and so forth. Yes, I think they have, you know, great intellectual capacity, so I've no doubt they're able to learn and use these different methods. But again, it doesn't address how the modern human language has evolved from the common ancestor that we showed over 6 million years ago. And I'm hoping to infer some of those behaviors by looking at modern apes.
Having done this work meticulously for so long, what next?
What next? Oh, well, I've got just bucketfuls of data to go through and continue growing this database. My hope for the near future is to get other scientists using this methodology, but the next real critical step is to use it as a platform for comparative analysis between humans and apes, particularly looking at preverbal children, because they're going to be using those social behaviors that are so critical to the normal development of language, and to look at children who have language impairments, because we know that these are the children who lack the normal development of some of these social behaviors that would normally give them the ability to acquire human language. And looking at all of this over a common scientific framework is going to allow us to have a much better clue about what's going on here.
Yes, you even mentioned autistic children, didn't you?
I did, and there's a pilot study kicking off at Birkbeck later this month to look at a group of low-functioning autistic children who don't have verbal skills, and looking at a group of age-matched, typical developing children to use this method that I've used with the apes to look at those social behaviours.
Gillian Sebastian Forrester has been a Daphne Jackson Fellow and is now at the University of Sussex.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.